You sure as hell ain't gonna get any action dressed like that. Becker frowned. I'm not looking for action. I just need to talk to her. Maybe you could help me find her. Two-Tone set down his beer. You a cop? Becker shook his head. The kid's eyes narrowed. You look like a cop. Kid, I'm from Maryland. If I were a cop, I'd be a little out of my jurisdiction, don't you think? The question seemed to stump him. My name's David Becker. Becker smiled and offered his hand across the table. The punk recoiled in disgust. Back off, fag boy. Becker retracted the hand. The kid sneered. I'll help you. But it'll cost you. Becker played along. How much? $100? Becker frowned. I've only got pesetas. Whatever. Make it 100 pesetas. Foreign currency exchange was obviously not one of Two-Tone's fortes. 100 pesetas was about 87 cents. Deal, Becker said, rapping his bottle on the table. The kid smiled for the first time. Deal. Okay, Becker continued in his hushed tone. I figure the girl I'm looking for might hang out here. She's got red, white, and blue hair. Two-Tone snorted. It's Judas Taboo's anniversary. Everybody's got... She's also wearing a British flag t-shirt and has a skull pendant in one ear. A faint look of recognition crossed Two-Tone's face. Becker saw it and felt a surge of hope. But a moment later, Two-Tone's expression turned stern. He slammed his bottle down and grabbed Becker's shirt. She's Eduardo's, you asshole. I'd watch it. You touch her, and he'll kill you. Chapter 56. Midge Milken prowled angrily into the conference room across from her office. In addition to the 32-foot mahogany table with the NSA seal inlaid in black cherry and walnut, the conference room contained 3 Marion Pike watercolors, a Boston fern, a marble wet bar, and, of course, the requisite Sparklets water cooler. Midge helped herself to a glass of water, hoping it might calm her nerves. As she sipped at the liquid, she gazed across at the window. The moonlight was filtering through the open Venetian blind and playing on the grain of the table. She'd always thought this would make a nicer director's office than Fontaine's current location on the front of the building. Rather than looking out over the NSA parking lot, the conference room looked out over an impressive array of NSA outbuildings, including the Crypto Dome, a high-tech island floating separate from the main building on 3 wooded acres. Purposefully situated behind the natural cover of a grove of maples, Crypto was difficult to see from most windows in the NSA complex, but the view from the directorial suite was perfect. To Midge, the conference room seemed the perfect vantage point for a king to survey his domain. She had suggested once that Fontaine move his office, but the director had simply replied, "Not on the rear." Fontaine was not a man to be found on the back end of anything. Midge pulled apart the blinds. She stared out at the hills. Sighing ruefully, she let her eyes fall toward the spot where Crypto stood. Midge always felt comforted by the sight of the Crypto Dome, a glowing beacon regardless of the hour. But tonight, as she gazed out, there was no comfort. Instead, she found herself staring into a void. As she pressed her face to the glass, she was gripped by a wild, girlish panic. Below her, there was nothing but blackness. Crypto had disappeared. Chapter 57. The crypto bathrooms had no windows, and the darkness surrounding Susan Fletcher was absolute. She stood dead still for a moment, trying to get her bearings, acutely aware of the growing sense of panic gripping her body. The horrible cry from the ventilation shaft seemed to hang all around her. Despite her effort to fight off a rising sense of dread, fear swept across her flesh and took control. In a flurry of involuntary motion, Susan found herself groping wildly across stall doors and sinks. Disoriented, she spun through the blackness with her hands out in front of her, trying to picture the room. She knocked over a garbage can and found herself against a tiled wall. Following the wall with her hand, she scrambled toward the exit and fumbled for the door handle. She pulled it open and stumbled out onto the crypto floor. There she froze for a second time. The crypto floor looked nothing like it had just moments ago. Translator was a gray silhouette against the faint twilight coming in through the dome. All of the overhead lighting was dead. Not even the electronic keypads on the doors were glowing. As Susan's eyes became accustomed to the dark, she saw that the only light in crypto was coming through the open trap door, a faint red glow from the utility lighting below. She moved toward it. There was the faint smell of ozone in the air. When she made it to the trap door, she peered into the hole. The freon vents were still belching, swirling mist through the redness, and from the higher-pitched drone of the generators, Susan knew crypto was running on backup power. Through the mist, she could make out Strathmore standing on the platform below. He was leaning over the railing and staring into the depths of Translator's rumbling shaft. "Commander?" There was no response. Susan eased onto the ladder. The hot air from below rushed in under her skirt. The rungs were slippery with condensation. She set herself down on the grated landing. "Commander!" Strathmore did not turn. He continued staring down with a blank look of shock, as if in a trance. Susan followed his gaze over the banister. For a moment she could see nothing except wisps of steam. Then suddenly she saw it. A figure. 6 stories below. It appeared briefly in the billows of steam. There it was again. A tangled mass of twisted limbs. Lying 90 feet below them, Phil Chartruckian was sprawled across the sharp iron fins of the main generator. His body was darkened and burned. His fall had shorted out Crypto's main power supply. But the most chilling image of all was not of Chartruckian, but of someone else. Another body halfway down the long staircase, crouched, hiding in the shadows. The muscular frame was unmistakable. It was Greg Hale. Chapter 58. The punk screamed at Becker. "Megan belongs to my friend Eduardo. You stay away from her." "Where is she?" Becker's heart was racing out of control. "Fuck you!" "It's an emergency," Becker snapped. He grabbed the kid's sleeve. "She's got a ring that belongs to me. I'll pay her for it. A lot." Two-Tone stopped dead and burst into hysterics. "You mean that ugly gold piece of shit is yours?" Becker's eyes widened. "You've seen it?" Two-Tone nodded coyly. "Where is it?" Becker demanded. "No clue," Two-Tone chuckled. "Megan was up here trying to hawk it." "She was trying to sell it?" "Don't worry, man. She didn't have any luck. You've got shitty taste in jewelry." "Are you sure nobody bought it? Are you shitting me? For $400? I told her I'd give her 50, but she wanted more. She was trying to buy a plane ticket. Stand by." Becker felt the blood drain from his face. "Where to?" "Fucking Connecticut," Two-Tone snapped. "Eddie's bumming." "Connecticut? Shit, yeah. Going back to Mommy and Daddy's mansion in the burbs. Hated her Spanish homestay family. 3 spick brothers always hitting on her. No fucking hot water." Becker felt a knot rise in his throat. "When is she leaving?" Two-Tone looked up. "When?" he laughed. "She's long gone by now. Went to the airport hours ago. Best spot to hawk the ring. Rich tourists and shit. Once she got the cash, she was flying out." A dull nausea swept through Becker's gut. "This is some kind of sick joke, isn't it?" He stood a long moment. "What's her last name?" Two-Tone pondered the question and shrugged. "What flight was she taking?" "She said something about the Roach Coach." "Roach Coach?" "Yeah, weekend red-eye. Seville, Madrid, LaGuardia. That's what they call it. College kids take it because it's cheap. Guess they sit in back and smoke roaches." "Great," Becker groaned, running a hand through his hair. What time did it leave? 2 a.m. sharp every Saturday night. She's somewhere over the Atlantic by now. Becker checked his watch. It read 1:45 p.m. He turned to Two-Tone, confused. You said it's a 2 a.m. flight? The punk nodded, laughing. Looks like you're fucked, old man. Becker pointed angrily to his watch. But it's only 1:45. Two-Tone eyed the watch, apparently puzzled. Well, I'll be damned, he laughed. I'm usually not this buzz till 4 a.m. What's the fastest way to the airport? Becker snapped. Taxi stand out front. Becker grabbed a 1,000 peseta note from his pocket and stuffed it in Two-Tone's hand. Hey, man, thanks, the punk called after him. If you see Megan, tell her I said hi. But Becker was already gone. Two-Tone sighed and staggered back toward the dance floor. He was too drunk to notice the man in wire-rimmed glasses following him. Outside, Becker scanned the parking lot for a taxi. There was none. He ran over to a stocky bouncer. Taxi. The bouncer shook his head. Demasiado temprano. Too early. Too early, Becker swore. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. But dame uno. Call me one. The man pulled out a walkie-talkie. He said a few words and then signed off. 20 minutos, he offered. 20 minutes, Becker demanded. ¿Y el autobús? The bouncer shrugged. 45 minutos. Becker threw up his hands. Perfect. The sound of a small engine turned Becker's head. It sounded like a chainsaw. A big kid and his chain-clad date pulled into the parking lot on an old Vespa 250 motorcycle. The girl's skirt had blown high on her thighs. She didn't seem to notice. Becker dashed over. I can't believe I'm doing this, he thought. I hate motorcycles. He yelled to the driver, I'll pay you 10,000 pesetas to take me to the airport. The kid ignored him and killed the engine. 20,000, Becker blurted. I need to get to the airport. The kid looked up. Scusi. He was Italian. Aeroporto, per favore, sulla Vespa, 20,000 pesetta. The Italian eyed his crummy little bike and laughed. 20,000 pesetta? La Vespa? 50,000, 50,000, Becker offered. It was about $400. The Italian laughed doubtfully. Dove la plata? Where's the cash? Becker pulled 5 10,000 peseta notes from his pocket and held them out. The Italian looked at the money and then at his girlfriend. The girl grabbed the cash and stuffed it in her blouse. Grazie, the Italian beamed. He tossed Becker the keys to his Vespa. Then he grabbed his girlfriend's hand, and they ran off laughing into the building. Aspetta, Becker yelled. Wait, I wanted a ride. Chapter 59. Susan reached for Commander Strathmore's hand as he helped her up the ladder onto the crypto floor. The image of Phil Chartruckian lying broken on the generators was burned into her mind. The thought of Hale hiding in the bowels of crypto had left her dizzy. The truth was inescapable. Hale had pushed Chartruckian. Susan stumbled past the shadow of translator back toward crypto's main exit, the door she'd come through hours earlier. Her frantic punching on the unlit keypad did nothing to move the huge portal. She was trapped. Crypto was a prison. The dome sat like a satellite, 109 yards away from the main NSA structure, accessible only through the main portal. Since crypto made its own power, the switchboard probably didn't even know they were in trouble. The main power's out, Strathmore said, arriving behind her. We're on OGS. The backup power supply in crypto was designed so that translator and its cooling systems took precedence over all other systems, including lights and doorways. That way, an untimely power outage would not interrupt Translator during an important run. It also meant Translator would never run without its Freon cooling system. In an uncooled enclosure, the heat generated by 3 million processors would rise to treacherous levels, perhaps even igniting the silicon chips and resulting in a fiery meltdown. It was an image no one dared consider. Susan fought to get her bearings. Her thoughts were consumed by the single image of the Sisek on the generators.